My first guest on this episode of the Casey Ferguson Show is the metal queen herself, Lee Aaron. Now, there might be a couple of you out there scratching your head, going, Lee Aaron, well, that name sounds awfully familiar. Well, that's because she's a multi-platinum selling artist, been nominated for 10 Junos, and won 3 Toronto Music Awards for Best Female Vocalist. Still having trouble, are you? Well, cocaine's a hell of a drug. Allow me to jog your memory. First up is Metal Queen. You might have checked this one out back in the day on Much Music's Power Hour, back when they actually used to play music videos. You remember that shit? Fuck, those were good times. Anyhow, this is Metal Queen. No dice, huh? Well, that was an early track. Maybe you'll know this one. This is the title track from her album, Some Girls Do. Getting a little warmer? All right, here's a little excerpt from her biggest hit, What You Do to My Body. Yeah, there you go. I knew you'd know that one. You don't like cocaine just the way it smells, right? Alright, now that we've got that sorted out, here's the first part of my conversation with the Metal Queen herself, Lee Aaron, on The Casey Ferguson Show.
Alright, this is Casey Ferguson. You are listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. My pants are getting tighter just knowing the Metal Queen herself, Lee Aaron, is on the other end of the phone. Thanks so much for taking the time, Lee. Welcome to The Casey Ferguson Show.
How you doing, Casey?
Well, like I said, the pants are getting tighter. I'm much better now that you're here.
Now, would this have something to do with the fact that we're all, you know, getting a little bit older and our waistlines are expanding?
That's probably part of it.
Okay. You know, I'm just trying to clean it up a little bit. You know?
Oh, come on now. You can't clean up this show. It's like polishing a turd.
All right.
I hear you went back to school.
I did.
How was that transition?
Well, it was interesting going back to school as an adult learner, because it's funny how when you're paying for your, like when you're a kid and you're in college, like back in the day, you know, you kind of monkey around and you're not taking your studies so seriously. But when you're paying for your own education, you hunker down and you get a 97 GPA.
Funny how that works.
But it was fun. You know, I went back to study some more stuff. You know, a lot of it was behavioral psychology and things like that, things I'm interested in. And, yeah, it's kind of fun to go back. I'm just the type of person, I'm always trying to reach for the next kind of thing that keeps me engaged in life, because I've never looked at myself as one of these people that just sort of gets into a rut of boredom. It's easy to fall into. And it doesn't matter what it is, I'm constantly trying to challenge myself. And it's interesting because I went back to college and I got, you know, my certification and stuff. And then I'm like, gee, what am I going to do now? Well, I guess I'm going to make a new record.
Well, as long as you promise not to psychoanalyze me on this show, I guess everything's all good.
I'll let you know at the end. So.
Okay. Fair enough.
Nice. Seeing him is compulsive psychosis, dashed with a jigger of psychopathic irresponsibility and violence.
You've been in the game a minute or two now, so how has your vocal process changed over the years? Do you warm up or baby your voice more these days?
You know, it's funny, because for years I didn't warm up, and then I had this conversation, gosh, I don't know, it was mid-80s. I really treated my voice badly in the very first few years of my career, and you know, back then I was battling with, you know, bad monitors and trying to sing above 2 blasting guitars on either side of the stage, and I definitely struggled with some vocal issues in the earliest, I'd say, segments of my career. And then I was backstage in Germany, and for a while, when Scorpions took a little time off because Klaus Meine had some vocal issues. I don't know if you remember that, back in the mid to late 80s, he had vocal issues and had to have an operation and nodules removed from his voice. So those guys started coming out to my shows, and I had this conversation backstage with Rudy Schenker, and he comes back, he's like, Lee, you know, your voice is fantastic, great, but you must take care. And he showed me all these vocal warm-ups. He said, you know, Klaus had to be doing these vocal warm-ups now. And from that point forward, I have tried to do vocal warm-ups before every show. And probably now that I'm a little bit older as well, I think I probably spend more intense time. I try to warm up for at least 30 minutes before a show, doing scales and singing a bit, just because it's sort of like, you know, you wouldn't, if you can, you know, bench press 300 pounds, you don't walk in and bench press 300 pounds. You walk in and you bench press 50, and then you work up to that. You know what
right.
I mean? So it's, yeah, I do take care of my voice.
Well, it's definitely an important thing to do. I mean, I had to learn, you know, the hard way. I pretty much shredded the top half of my range, you know, just not always singing stuff that's, you know, in the right key for me, and having to work to hit it, but, you know, also, you know, drinking too much and not watching what I eat and warming up and warming down. And people don't realize, I mean, it's a muscle like anything else. If you don't, you know, if you don't take care of it, you can fuck yourself up pretty good.
True enough. And the other thing too, it, unlike other muscles, it's like, you know, has this constant sort of stream of saliva, and everything that you eat passes by your vocal cords. Everything that you drink passes by your vocal cords. You know what I mean? So it's a bit of a sensitive area. I know that about 3 or 4 years ago, I got really sick with pneumonia for the first time in my life, and I was put on a variety of, several antibiotics, one back to back, none of which really worked. Probably I didn't need antibiotics at all, but that seems to be like you go into the doctor and that's what they prescribe. But at the end of it all, my pneumonia got better, and I couldn't speak for weeks, and I had to make an appointment with the top vocal specialist here at VGH, Vancouver General Hospital here in Vancouver, and turned out that at the end of all of these antibiotics, my immune system was so busted down from all of the drugs I was given, I had a fungal infection on my vocal cords that no doctor had caught. They just said, oh, you know, it's just the end of your pneumonia, you're getting over it. So this guy, you know, prescribed to me the proper medications, and, you know, I was tickety-boo within a couple of weeks. So it's amazing how fragile, you know, that area of your body is. So, yeah, I learned the hard way. You really have to take care of it.
Well, I had Tom Kiefer from Cinderella on this show, and I mean, the bullshit that guy went through, you know, and basically what they ended up attributing his, because he had the one paralyzed vocal cord, what they attributed that to was that when you get a really bad cold or something, it can lodge itself in the nerve and cause that.
Yeah, this doctor, you don't even want to know what I went through, because I had paralysis partly on one of my vocal cords and some scar tissue, and I had like cortisone injections directly into my neck.
Jesus.
Into my vocal cords. And, you know, you should have, it was sort of, yeah, it was mildly Clockwork Orange. That's what all I'm going to tell you. It was very interesting. I, you know, he's coming out with these needles. So I was like, oh, I'm like, really? Seriously? You're going to stick those things into my neck? And he's like, don't worry, you know, Ms. Aaron, I've done this like 1,000 times. And it actually didn't hurt as much as I thought. It mostly tasted terrible because you could feel the cortisone going into your vocal cords.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's important to have a good vocal doctor, which I do. So yeah, I've learned that taking care of my voice is very, very important. It's your instrument, right? So
absolutely. Now, I read that you were intimidated in the studio early on, and your manager would have to dose you with Southern Comfort to make you more comfortable.
Well, actually, that's a bit of an urban legend. It's partially true. My very first studio experience, when I was a young girl, I was 18 years old when I met my first manager. 18, I don't think I was quite 19 yet. And so, yeah, he had this vision in his head that, you know, he was sort of Svengalying the next Janis Joplin. So when I got into the studio, I was stiff. I'd never been in a professional recording studio. I'd done some 16-track demos with my first band when I was in high school, but never a pro studio. So, yeah, I was a bit nervous, and he's like, oh, you know, Janis Joplin always drank Southern Comfort, and that helped her loosen her voice up. So he plied me with Southern Comfort, but no, it wasn't me going out and buying me. I don't even think I was old enough to buy my own Southern Comfort at that point in time. Yeah. So that's kind of the urban myth unraveled.
Gotcha. Well, did you get more comfortable in the studio as time went on?
Oh, yeah. It's like riding a bike after a while. You get comfortable. These days, I look at being in the studio as sort of this fun adventure because I've learned so much about recording and stuff. So it's sort of like, let's see what this mic sounds like. Ooh, that one sounds neat. Let's see what it sounds like if we put a small room on me or this or that or, you know, I really relish the opportunity to get in the studio and experiment with techniques and vocal miking and, you know, things, and see what kind of great sounds we can get. One thing I don't like about modern recording, however, is the overuse of auto-tune features and things like that.
Amen.
Where you're listening and, you know, it sounds like a robot that you're kind of listening to, not a human. So.
Well, and I think to a degree, even, you know, the performances that, you know, they get chopped up so much and so on and so forth. I mean, it's not like listening to a Zeppelin record or a Stones record where you heard some of those mistakes, but that was kind of part of what made it so cool and so rock and roll.
Yeah, absolutely. It made it human. It sounded, you know, there's something that, I don't know if you are aware, but I just finished recording a new album. Right now we're talking to some possible distribution partners. So it's kind of been tough for me because everyone's saying, when's the release date? When's the release date? And I'm like, well, I don't know yet. Like, if it was up to me, I'd have a release date set for next month. But if we're going to be partnering with someone for either North American or worldwide distribution, they're going to probably have something to say about, number one, the song sequencing, the title, and the release date. It sort of depends on the timelines, right? But anyway, to make a long story short, so that's sort of, that answered another question you might have asked in the future, which is, when is your album coming out?
Yeah, that's okay. Save me from asking it.
Yeah. So the answer is very soon, but we're just waiting on a couple things. But anyway, you know, this album, when I wanted to record it, one of the things that was super important to me was getting my live band, the band that I actually have played these songs with, wrote, tested them out in live situations and did pre-production to get, you know, the entire band in the studio playing the songs together at the same time, like living, breathing musicians that, you know, it's a heads-up gig where you're actually looking at each other and you're working off each other and it sounds like humanoids playing together, because so many records most records are not done that way anymore, you know, and there's something that is lost. You know, you don't, like those, you know, you listen to something like The Who live at Leeds, you can't fake that.
Absolutely.
You know, you can't make that happen with programmed drums and sending your files back and forth coast to coast to have, we'll send it back to LA and have so-and-so put his guitar on it. Well, you're not going to get the same kind of feeling that you get when you get the magic of players that work together really well and are working off each other when you're in a studio together. So that's how we went and did this album, is we did it live off the floor. Yeah, you know, we did some vocal overdubs and guitar overdubs later, but the core bed tracks of the album is done live off the floor.
So what else can you tell me about this record? I mean, is it a bit of a change of direction on some tunes for you? Or are you kind of going back to your roots? Is it closer to Emotional Rain, a bit of a heavier influence? What's going on there?
It's a rock record, for sure. It's kind of hard to describe because it's not, to say it's like Body Rock 2015 would be completely wrong. I mean, there's elements of Body Rock on it, but my goal was not to make something that was just a rehash of something that I'd already done. You know me, I'm always doing something different. This album mostly was inspired by, really, like, my kids' love of, they're starting to get into music now, and they're starting to like stuff, and I'm going, oh man, you know, don't listen to One Direction, don't listen to that crap. Let me play you some real music. Let me play you, this is what Mom liked when she was, like, a young girl, you know, and I, you know, I'll pull out an old, you know, Elton John record or some Fleetwood Mac or...
Amen.
The more I started doing this, the more I started kind of revisiting all of this music that I listened to as a emerging teen. And it's kind of a funny story, and it's something we've included in the new bio, actually, is when I was, 14, 15 years old, this is the late 70s, my dad and my mom both worked at Humber College in Toronto. And one day my dad showed up at home and he had a trunk full of vinyl albums. And I'm like, you know, Dad, like, what is this? And, you know, I was like so excited. And what had happened is their college radio station had made the transition to 8-track and they just were getting rid of all the vinyl. So my father showed up with all this vinyl in his trunk, and in that pile of vinyl was like Rumours, Fleetwood Mac, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, Elton John, Led Zeppelin 2, Led Zeppelin 3, the first couple of Runaways albums.
Oh, wow.
So it was Susie Quattro, I'm just trying to think, David Bowie, like all this Heart, oh my gosh, there was like Dreamboat Annie and Little Queen, just a bunch of stuff. And I mean, so this became my playlist when I was like 14, 15 years old. I just played these albums over and over and over again. And when I started writing this record, I wrote a bunch of stuff on my own, and I co-wrote some stuff with Sean Kelly, who's my guitar player from Toronto.
He's fantastic.
Yes, Sean's amazing. But that's how our conversation first started. He said, you know, if you could do a bunch of covers, what would you do? And so I sent him a sort of a playlist of all the songs I loved growing up. And he's like, that is a really cool playlist. Why don't we think about recording some of those, and why don't we start doing some writing as well? So we started writing, and I started writing on my own. And over the next probably 9 months, all of a sudden it was like this evolution. We had 11 songs, and we're like, well, actually, we don't really need to record any covers because we've got 11 originals here. And so my modus operandi was not to go in with like a, okay, this is going to be a rock record that sounds like Suzy Quatro, or this is going to be a rock record that sounds like this. It was, this is going to be a rock record, but I'm just going to let all of these influences that I absorbed when I was a teen, just allow them to come out. So when you hear this album, it sounds like a Lee Aaron record. But to me, I think they're really, really solid songs, really, really good song craftsmanship. And you like, you know, you hear big guitars, but you hear like a little bit of Zeppelin, a little bit of Fleetwood Mac in there, a little bit of the Runaways, a little bit of Elton John. Like you hear like these sort of solid rock influences in there. I don't really know how to describe it. You know, I'm excited about it. I can't wait for it to hit the airwaves for people to hear it.
Well, certainly when the record comes out, make sure I get a copy. I'd love to spend some here on the Casey Ferguson Show.
It will happen.
Excellent. Did you use headphones this time? Because I heard, maybe it's another myth, but I heard that when you were doing Metal Queen or Call of the Wild, when you were recording something anyway, and you had a problem with headphones. You wanted to use studio monitors instead.
Where did you read all this stuff?
You know, I get that a lot. I'm a research nerd.
Oh, so did you find this stuff on my Euro site? Like,
I got that from an interview that you did, and I'm trying to think of what the hell the website was. It was a print interview.
It was very, very interesting. I'm always thrown a little bit off when people do research and they bring up things that I don't even remember. But, you know, I do remember, it was Metal Queen, actually, not Call of the Wild. But I don't remember why, but I went into the studio and some of those songs were so full on powerful. I just had difficulties, headphone on, headphone off, you know? And in the end, I remember we ended up recording that album using studio monitors on either side of me so I could hear myself. So it sounded like a lot more like a live situation. And one other kind of bizarre geek thing about me that nobody knows is that I have a lot of trouble singing into a mic that's on a stand. It's even if it's like the most, you know, a $10,000, you know, Telefunken microphone, I need to wrap something around it and hold it. So I need to handhold my mic no matter the cost. Because I remember being in the studio multiple times and going, don't drop that microphone. It's like $8,000. So we'd get the tea towel and the gaffer tape and gaff it up so it wouldn't be going every time my hand moved around on it. And
I can understand this stuff as a singer, but wouldn't you get bleed from the monitors on the track?
Oh, I'm sure we did. I'm sure we did, but, you know, it was the track, so it bled in, and I don't know. Ask Paul Gross, the guy that produced that record. I don't know.
Sure. Wow, just some clever engineering there or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, we did all kind. You know, this was back in the day when, during mixes, all of us were on the console, and, you know, we had, okay, you're fader number 8, and fader number 11, and you're, you know, fading the guitar solo down at the end of his riff. You know, those were the good old fun days, hey?
Oh, absolutely. Unfortunately, I missed a lot of it. I was born in 83, so by the time I got into the music biz, things were certainly on the downswing, in my view, just given the style of music that I like, or not that I just listen to one thing, but certainly the era of Guns N' Roses and Motley Crue and all these bands that I loved was pretty much gone. I mean, by the time I got into high school, I mean, it was like Limp Bizkit and Creed, and I'm going, this is garbage. Like, what the hell, you know? So I was always going back and listening to, you know, I'm sure that's when I discovered your music. You know, I was going back to, you know, the used record stores or, you know, buying tapes. You know, you get like 3 for $1 or something at this point, you know, and I just like picked up all this old stuff, you know, whether it was Dokken or even sometimes you could find like a Whitesnake tape or something. But I was going back and listening to that stuff. But unfortunately, by the time time that I was out playing the bars, I mean, that era of rock and roll had pretty much passed. I mean, grunge had, you know, and we'll certainly get to how that affected your career, but everything that was dangerous about it had pretty much been drummed out in my estimation by then, you know?
I hear you, absolutely.
Here's another one that's going to freak you out, Lee.
Okay, sure.
This is a quote from you from that same interview regarding the sexual nature of how you were marketed early on.
Uh-huh.
You said, "I tried to defend it by saying that I was a forward-thinking woman, a forerunner for the liberation of women in charge of their own careers. In fact, my manager pretty much scripted that response for me as a stock answer to such attacks. The ironic thing is, when that happened, I wasn't in charge of anything at all. I was lying to myself so I wouldn't have to feel bad about being exploited at such a young age." Here's my question. I still hear female artists today using very similar responses, and I'm guessing that some of the same things are going on behind the scenes. So what advice do you have for someone like, say, Miley Cyrus?
I'm sorry for hesitating, because you know what? I don't really know anything about the behind the scenes workings of her career and who is marketing her and what of these things are her decisions and what are not. I think, you know, I know Chrissy Hynde recently spoke out and said some stuff about the way a lot of these women are.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just using Miley as an example. I mean, we could say Lady Gaga. There's any number of them, but even a young artist coming out today, I mean, what would you say to them so that they don't end up in the same situation or make some of these decisions that they may regret later on?
The reality is, at that time for me, I wanted to believe that I was being empowering to women, when deep down inside, I have to say that the older I got, the more I realized how much it damaged my self-esteem, because the music was not first. How I looked and how I was marketed was the cart in front of, it was like putting the cart in front of the horse. And I see that trend in music today. I don't know to what degree the female artists out there are complicit in their agreement to be marketed that way. And, you know, I don't think I'm an old-fashioned person, but I think that, you know, Chrissy Hynde is correct in that, you know, she recently came out and she just said that they're like the sex workers of music, because they're not selling music. There's nothing wrong with being an attractive woman. I mean, you know, but one of the greatest artists of all time, Patti Smith, was not a glamorous and overly attractive woman, but man, she was attractive in her power and attractive in her intellect. And I think that there definitely needs to be more focus on that. I don't like the way that I see music going. And I think that, you know, I've worked really hard in the last few years to kind of shift that for myself in the way that I've been marketed. And especially now that I have children, I have a young girl, I have a daughter who's 11 years old, and I don't want Miley to be her number one role model. God, no.
Amen.
There's got to be better role models than that. You know?
Part talk show, part rock show, you are listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. That was the first part of my conversation with Lee Aaron. I'll have more from that conversation on future episodes of The Casey Ferguson Show. I would spin it for you now, but there's still a lot to get to on this episode of the show, so with that in mind, I'm going to move on, but check out LeeAaron.com for all things Metal Queen related, including tour dates. I bring this up because she's going to be performing in my hometown of Kingston, Ontario, Friday, November 20th at 8 p.m. at Overtime Sports Bar. Tickets are $30, and you can get them from ticketweb.ca. Also on the bill that night, a couple local openers I think you'll enjoy, Blue Angel and Kingstone. So get yourself some tickets. I will be there as well. If you see me, feel free to come over and shoot the shit, or do a shot for that matter.
Well, he's a raging alcoholic on the highway to hell, but other than that, yeah, he's fine.